to ask about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Mays, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Tom Baltz, and he'll be answering your most important questions on the Pennsylvania Trio. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Tom a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Tom Baltz about the Pennsylvania Trio. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as an unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly and Kodiak rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world for over 15 years, including Dave Whitlock, one of fly fishing's greatest innovators. Dave said, "With my Watermaster, I can enjoy more fishing per hour than any other method I have tried. After 2.5 years of testing 15 models of kick boats, I'm convinced that the Watermaster is the ultimate personal flotation craft for warm and cold water fly fishing." Visit Watermaster today and take a look at what, how Dave Whitlock puts it, the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to www.bigskyinflatables.com. That's bigskyinflatables.com. Before we introduce Tom, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Shot Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Tom's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $25 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. And to win that, and you can redeem that either online or in their store, to win that you must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And that question will be something that we talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and be fast about it. First person in that has the correct answer wins, and to get that $25 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. Our guest tonight is Tom Baltz. Tom, a New Mexico native, has been a fly tyer for over 50 years. Those, since the mid-1970s, spent among the legendary tyers and anglers of the limestone valleys of south-central Pennsylvania near Carlisle. Tom is the only four-time Pennsylvania State fly tying champion, and his flies have appeared in Field & Stream, Fly Fishing, Fisherman Magazine, Art of Angling Journal, Eastern Fly Fishing, and American Angler Magazine, the Orvis Catalog, and numerous other books and publications. Tom ties fishing and collector flies for discriminating anglers coast to coast. His trout and salmon flies are in the collections of the Pennsylvania State Museum, the Pennsylvania Fly Fishing Museum, the Anglers Club of New York, and private collectors such as Dick Cheney in, through Europe and also the U.S. to Asia. A full-time fly fishing professional since 1974, one of the Pennsylvania's first licensed fishing guides. Tom is an Orvis-endorsed fly fishing guide who is named Northeast Trout Guide of the Year 2001 by Orvis, a signal honor resulting from client feedback. Tom is a member of the Regal Engineering, the Regal Vice Company. He's on the pro staff, and his wife, Eileen, he and his wife, Eileen, live outside Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania, very near Mountain Creek, the Latorte, and the lovely Yellow Breeches. Well, Tom, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you, Roger. It's a pleasure.
Well, good to have you. Winding down the summer here and getting into some nice fall fishing. I'm sure it's leaves are probably starting to turn out there a bit too, aren't they?
We're getting a little bit of color on some of the vegetation. Trees, it's a little bit early, but the poison ivy vines and things like that are showing some red and yellow. And we've had such a hot, dry summer. Thankfully, we're getting a little thunderstorm right now and a little bit of rain. So hopefully that pumps up the fishing a bit.
Well, good. Yeah, it's starting to turn into nice fall fishing weather out here in Colorado. So we haven't had much rain either this summer, but I'm not sure what the winter will bring. You never know around here. Anyway, we're here to talk about Pennsylvania's Latorte, Yellow Breeches, and Big Spring Creeks, three kind of world-famous creeks, I guess, in many people's minds, and have been talked about for many, many years. But we've never done a show on them, so I thought this would be great. And since you live right around the corner from these places, I'm sure you can share some great information with us. So let's start with a little history on these three spring creeks. And, you know, I know they're very close. I mean, these are within minutes of each other, basically, right?
From the Yellow Breeches over to Big Spring might be a half an hour, and the Latorte's kind of in between them. So you can cover at least two of them in an average day's fishing. You know, it's fun to maybe hit one for a while and then try the other one for one of the others for part of the day as well.
So it's
nice. There's a little bit of convenience that way.
Yeah, what's some of the history you can tell us about these creeks?
Well, one of the notable things about them, each are a little different than the others. Big Spring and the Latorte are both pure spring creeks. In other words, you look at them, they're full of aquatic vegetation. You can follow them upstream to the point where they literally come out of the ground. I mean, you can say the stream starts right here. Now, their actual watershed is a little sneaky because it's kind of hidden underground. They've actually done dye tests on the springs that feed the Big Spring, and they know some of the sources of the water that that surfaces and enters and creates the Big Spring come from quite some miles away in a couple cases. The Yellow Breeches is a little bit different. Its upper reaches are pretty Spring Creek-like, but it drains the kind of the south side of the Cumberland Valley, the South Mountain in general, and it's got a combination of limestone springs that feed it and little freestone streams that come out of the South Mountain. So in some ways, it's my favorite stream in the area because of its diversity. The Spring Creeks, I mean, they are flat water mostly. Big Spring has some riffles on it. Latorte, very few. And limited variety of bugs as far as hatches go. And the Yellow Breeches has quite a bit more variety in the way of mayflies, caddisflies, midges, some little stoneflies. They're not, they don't carry the importance that streams out west do, but nonetheless, there are little stoneflies in there as well. It starts off as a very small stream. Its upper stream bed is actually intermittent, where it divides and goes up into the South Mountain into two little tiny streams that have wee tiny little brook trout in them. And I mean like 3 or 4 inches is max size. But a lot of those little streams that come out of the mountains sink as they leave the mountains and sink into the sand and gravel substrate, and that is the sponge that holds the water that then resurfaces in these springs. And so that makes a fairly rich stream, too, that carries a fair head of insect life. And from small water in the upper reaches to pretty good-sized water in the lower reaches, where you have to be careful where you wade around, and especially in the spring. You know, it's big enough to knock you over or flat out prevent anyone with common sense from trying to cross. So
yeah.
You can get a little bit of everything on the breaches.
Now, these streams were fished by some pretty famous fly fishers in the past, right?
Whether the fly fishers made the streams or the streams made the fly fishers or a little bit of each is probably a interesting debate. But, yes, the Latorte particularly, but also the Big Spring and the Breeches drew anglers from far and wide. I get often get asked what the yellow breeches was like way back when, before European settlement, and nobody knows. That I have never found anything, any documentation on that. I could take some guesses, but the Latourte and Big Spring are both fairly short streams that run. I think Big Spring is 5 point some miles. The Latourte is a little over six, and they stay cold from one end to the other. And back in the day, they were totally populated by brook trout. There's records of British Army officers prior to the French and Indian War in the 1750s driving out with all their baggage and caravan, et cetera, and staying for days at a time to fish, particularly fish Big Spring. The Latourte runs right through Carlisle, which was the edge of the frontier in those days, so I'm sure they fished there as well. But in later years, prior to World War II, Vince Marinaro and Charlie Fox were two notable anglers. They were part of a regular group of anglers that fished the Latourte and Big Spring, too. And what made the stream special in the long run was that they were thinking anglers. They developed fly patterns and techniques and wrote about those fly patterns and fly designs and techniques. And that's how, you know, word gets out about streams. Of course, that Vince Marinaro probably wrote the most famous best American fly fishing book, and that was A Modern Dry Fly Code, which came out in 1950 originally. It's still a wonderful book to read. And in that, these guys did not invent terrestrial fishing, but they did kind of codify it and make some kind of sense out of it. And their idea was that the trout would see these terrestrial insects in basically two dimensions, length and width. The depth, the height of the bug didn't matter as much. So Vince, of course, his very famous fly, the Jacid, and some other similar flies that they came up with. And then Vince came up with his thorax duns, which are many people have tried to tie them, but I only know maybe a half a dozen people that know how to tie them the way Vince did. Vince showed them. Vince was a little sneaky. He never quite gave it up in his book. So he gave up most of it, but not all of it. So the streams, Vince especially tried to import the traditions of the English chalk stream fishing to the Latourte and a little bit lesser extent to Big Spring. You know, you spot and stalk the fish. Charlie Fox and his water that he owned along the Latourte, they maintained benches and a little fishing hut. Vince would spend his vacations there in the summer. He would come over for days at a time and stay in that fishing hut and tie flies. And in fact, one interesting note as to how the word got out on the Jacid is Vince was catching some fish that nobody else could catch on the Latourte. There was a great big bend in the stream that was right where I-81, the Interstate 81, runs today. They cut the bend off and straightened this. They just cut a little neck there and then built the highway right through there. So that whole area is gone. But Vince would be catching these fish that nobody else could catch, and he wouldn't show anybody his flies. So Charlie told me about this, that a couple of them kind of watched Vince from a distance until he got hung up and snapped a fly off in a bush. And they went through and rooted through the whole bush until they found this a strange fly that they didn't recognize. They assumed that was Vince's fly. And then upon confronting him, he did kind of chuckle and admit that was what he had been using. So everybody it was a game. It's, you know, that's the way fishing was in those days, and it's to an extent still is. There's dues to pay, and it's not all for free. So that's kind of how the word got out on the Jacid. But the Big Spring was noted for midge fishing, and it's the first stream in the country. I mean, the earliest documentation of what we would call midge fishing. In the 1800s, mid to late 1800s, the locals were making their little tiny flies, little bitty tiny wet flies that tackled. This wasn't conducive to what we dry fly fishing as we know it today, especially with little stuff. But they were fishing with flies that were equivalent to and smaller than what we would call size 20s today. They snelled them, made their hooks out of needles. They removed the temper and retemper them, bend them, snell them, tie these little tiny wet flies on them. And these were for brook trout. These are not regular mountain-type brook trout that would grab size 12 royal wolves. They were, even back in those days, they took little tiny midges. And the upper mile or so of Big Spring was estimated at one time to have over 600,000 brook trout in it. I'll address some of the other issues on those streams a little further down the road here.
Sure.
The Yellow Breeches, a much larger stream, 50-some miles long, depending on whose data you're looking at. And it had a number of, unknown number, in fact, of mills on it over the years. The first settlers in this area were farmers, and the people who ran the mills and ground their grains and things up followed them, and it was all about water power. All these streams around here had mills on them that ran steel industry and boiling springs and ground grain and sawed logs and did all that sort of thing. But water power was what they had in the 1700s and first half of the 1800s and later. So we're still dealing with that legacy, but I'll address some of that a little bit later, too. So that's okay. A real brief rundown.
Sure, sure. Michael Knagg in Michigan wrote in, and he asked, what changes have you seen over the many years that you've been familiar with these fabled limestone creeks of Pennsylvania? 20 years ago, there were grave reports of degradation happening in the region's resources. Has the decline continued, or has there been good news for the fishery in general and the habitat at large?
I'm guessing that what he refers to as 20 years ago and the degradation, et cetera, related to Big Spring. It's for a mile and some odd distance of stream, it's generated tremendous controversy and interest and made national headlines in Fly Fisherman magazine and I'm sure other places as well. And it all had to do with the hatchery that was on the top end of Big Spring that the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission ran. At one time, the whole upper end of the stream had, as I mentioned, estimated over 600,000 brook trout in it. Some people hear reports and think that there were 3, 4, 5 pound brook trout in there, but it's not a very big stream, and about maybe 18 inches with an occasional larger one was about high end. Charlie Fox told me back in the day that 12 inches or so was about what most of them were, like brook trout everywhere. Somebody would catch a bigger one occasionally, so. Some of those reports were a little bit exaggerated, and time makes the memory grow fonder. But that hatchery, there was a commercial hatchery that operated for some years, and the remains are still there if you know where to look. But without going into where it is, it's unimportant. There's nothing to see. The effluent from that commercial hatchery caused the brook trout fishery to crash, and this was way back, maybe in the 60s or so. Before my time here. Then I think in the 60s is when the Fish Commission acquired the length of the stream, and they put a hatchery in at the very, very top end of it and discharged into the stretch that for many years has been known as the ditch. That was an old mill pond. That was what powered the last mill that operated on Big Spring. The effluent from that hatchery, the Fish Commission was raising way too many fish, and the stream was being made a sacrificial lamb for stock trout that were mostly stocked in the southeastern corner of Pennsylvania, not even around here. It was their most productive hatchery, and they were forced to close it due to the fact that they couldn't meet their discharge permits. So anyway, that got closed, and around 2000, somewhere in that range, and the stream's improved tremendously since then. So the present situation there, our Trout Unlimited chapter, Cumberland Valley chapter, and the Big Spring Watershed Association and the Fish Commission partnered up with grant money. We have probably $900,000, also Pennsylvania Turnpike money. As part of that money, $900,000 in money and in-kind services and materials and things and habitat projects that really showed tremendous promise early on. and it's here right now to have peaked out. But nonetheless, the stream is way better fishing. We have a good mile and a half that's fly fishing only, as opposed to 200 yards that we had before. And mostly rainbows and brook trout, almost no brown trout in there at all. Occasionally a huge brown trout's caught. A friend of mine caught one a few years ago that was, I measured it personally, 32 and a half inches, and we figured about 15 and a half pounds. It was also caught later on after we released it up in the catch and release area by a local guy who was fishing bait for it and couldn't even catch it on Nightcrawler, so he snagged it. I have a picture of it, and I'm guessing that fish is 18 pounds. It's huge. So that's an anomaly, though. The stream is brook trout and rainbows. There's been a tremendous controversy about whether it should be made just a brook trout stream. Some people consider these to be native brook trout. Back in the days when the hatchery was still open, I spent hundreds of hours of summer up there, and my opinion is that most of the brook trout were gone before they closed the hatchery. There were very few in the upper end. I think they were mostly hatchery fish, and any number of strains of brook trout have been stocked in there over the years. So they're all wild brook trout, and that's a good thing. Whether they're native brook trout is another question that has not been answered yet. Most anglers are plenty happy to have wild brook trout, and they don't care if they're native or not, and wild rainbows. By our surveys that the Fish Commission's done, Big Spring is the best brook trout stream in Pennsylvania, and it's also the best rainbow trout stream in Pennsylvania on a pounds per hectare basis. So it's given up some tremendous rainbows. I'm talking about fish in the 30-inch class. More typically, you could hope to catch something in the 15 or 16-inch class with some fish going 20-plus, and occasionally somebody would get a really big one.
Yeah.
So that's a nutshell on Big Spring. The Latorte, I'm not so sure that the upper reaches are quite as good as they were when I first fished it in the late 60s. But there's still vestiges of that fishing around. The wild brown trout are still in there. And, you know, you can still, if you get over there when they haven't been harassed too much, you'll still find fish that rise, and you can catch them on the little small terrestrials. The good news on the Latorte is that the lower reaches below Carlisle are well into the Class A brown trout range. And that all was polluted back in the Fox days and Marinero days. Industries in Carlisle had the lower reaches of the Latorte virtually unlivable for trout. So there's several miles of water downstream from the U.S. Army War College that have plenty of brown trout in there, and they're all wild fish. No one stocks it. So that's the good news there. The yellow breeches also has good news in general in that some of these mill dams that I referred to earlier have been removed. Every time they remove a mill dam, the upswing in the trout fishery is just phenomenal. I mean, it's like 100 times better than it was, maybe more than that. So there's been some dam removals, and in those general areas, and that goes for up and downstream quite some distance on the stream, the trout fishing has gotten way better in those areas, and I'm not talking about just stock trout. The yellow breeches does get some stock trout and also has fair head of wild brown trout in some stretches. In fact, I had a guy catch a little wild rainbow the other day. Not a common event, but nonetheless. So it's always a mixed bag. Some good news and some we would like to, you know, hear a little bit better on, but still nice fishing.
Yeah, sounds like in general pretty healthy fisheries, all three of them. Yeah. And getting better. Well, we need to take a quick break here, Tom. When we come back, we'll talk more about these famed three creeks in Pennsylvania. So hang tight. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Tom Valtz about the Pennsylvania trio, the Latort, Yellow Breeches, and Big Spring Creeks. And if you'd like to ask Tom a question about any of these creeks, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Tom, I was asked my guests, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world, and so what have you been up to? I know you're always on the show circuit. Is that on the horizons here?
Yes, we'll be starting the show circuit up the weekend before Thanksgiving is the International Fly Tying Symposium in Somerset, New Jersey, and then the serious circuit starts with the fly fishing shows. Of course, I've done the Denver show for many years, and that's usually the first weekend in January. I do the big Somerset show in the last weekend in January, and the show in Lancaster, PA. These are all the fly fishing show. The Lancaster show is usually the weekend closest to the beginning of March. So I'm not certain offhand of exactly what the dates are, but you can go to their website and get all that information on there. It's just flyfishingshow.com, I think. So there'll be some all smaller local and regional appearances as well, but not some of that stuff isn't all scheduled yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, is there a place, do you have a website where people can find out where you're going to be or anything like that?
That I do not.
Okay.
You know, people have asked me about why I don't have a website. When the fishing's good, I'm so busy, I don't have time to maintain a website. And when the fishing's not good, I don't think the website's going to get me any business I don't already have. So,
okay.
For fly tying and stuff, what I do is I do report on the yellow breeches on a weekly basis at least on the Orvis website. They have over 250 fisheries around the country. Where you can get on the Orvis website and navigate through it to the fishing reports. And I try and keep mine fairly well updated and put the latest stuff on there, what's happening fly-wise and so forth. So,
yeah, okay, good. Well, sounds good. Well, maybe we'll see you in Denver again. That's when I saw you last.
I hope so.
Yeah, good.
I invite email questions and things like that all the time, too. If somebody wants to email me, have a question, or call.
Okay.
You know, I'm happy to answer questions and so forth.
Did you want to share those with
my regular home phone number is area code 717-486-7438, and you can always leave a message there if I'm not available immediately. And my email is B, as in boy, A-L-T-Z-T-E. There's no spaces. That's B-A-L-T-Z-T-E at AOL.com.
Okay.
So hopefully,
Great. Well, thanks for sharing that. Yeah, you never know. People get follow up or want to come to the area.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always
happy
to
entertain questions. Sure.
Yeah, good. Okay, we did get a question here on the Internet. Phil wrote in, and he wants to know what happened to the guy who snagged the big brown.
Nothing.
Nothing? He just kept it? Or?
From what I heard from one of the other local guys that knows who he is, he showed it around town for a couple of days until it spoiled and he threw it away.
Oh, my God. Oh
yeah,
my.
Nobody saw him get it. So I have the picture I have. He was in a parking lot where you can fish. He was right below the catch and release area, and you can fish bait or whatever. So once he got in there, he was legal, I guess. Nobody saw him catch the fish. The guy who took the picture lives along the stream, and asked him where he caught it, and he kind of nodded. He didn't say too much. He told another guy from Newville about it, and who told me about it, and that's how I got the picture. It got forwarded several times. So, yeah, I have the picture, and I have him holding the fish, but nobody has any picture of him fishing. So, he's still sneaking around. I'm sure still doing what he does.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
So.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, it's, I remember, and if it's legal, it's legal. It may not meet with all of our ideals, but You know, people. I know a lot of the game wardens around here. You know, they'll give you grief if you give people grief about keeping fish or something that are legal, because they're paying for license fees and everything as well. You know, so.
Yeah. Well, had the guy caught it on bait down below the Neely Road, it would have been legal.
Right, if that's what he did. Yeah.
Actually, his one buddy. One of his competitors, who was also fishing bait for this fish, these guys knew about it. He got mad because the guy snagged it. He didn't even catch. I mean,
yeah.
There's a pecking order even amongst the poachers.
Yeah.
What we understand is that the guy, this is how we found out a little bit more about it, the guy who didn't catch it was also trying to catch it on bait in the catch and release area. But he got mad because the other guy didn't catch it fair and square on bait. He snagged it. I mean, he foul hooked it. So he kind of gave him up. But, you know, it was all he said, she said. So,
yeah.
You know, as far as
yeah.
the Fish Commission, they couldn't cite anybody or do anything about it. But
So,
there's no honor among thieves. And
no.
They'll give each other up in a hurry.
We had some other questions, kind of general questions. Bob in Columbia, Maryland wrote in and said, have you noticed any of the regular hatches being off schedule due to the excessive number of hot days we've been experiencing? More precisely, have our hatch charts shifted?
That's pretty difficult to answer because hatch charts are so variable anyway from year to year. I mean, you know, you can say such and such a hatch, the whitefly, which I'm sure we're going to talk more about here in a little while, usually starts around the middle of August. But I've seen that vary by 2 weeks earlier than that and a week or more later than that date. So you just kind of have to be ready and go when you hear they're on, or keep, you know, time on the water. You go out, go find it yourself. Sometimes you get there early and nobody else knows about it. But
yeah.
You could maybe say that in a general sense, some of the hatches in the spring are a bit earlier than they used to be, a week or so. This would be on the yellow breeches primarily. And some of the fall hatches are a little bit later than they used to be, especially this year had such a long, hot, dry summer. The trico fishing on the breaches has been more or less a no-show so far, and I don't know why that is. If we have a big flood, I understand it might wash some of the little nymphs out, but we haven't had any high water. I mean, big, bad high water for, you know, since 2 years ago at least. So
yeah.
I don't know why we're not seeing more, and they may build up a little bit here yet. I'm looking for the little olives and stuff in the fall on the breaches. The spring creeks, generally speaking, are pretty steady as far as when the flies start. The water temperatures don't vary very often, very much. The water levels don't vary so much, whereas yellow breaches drains over 300 square miles, and it can change rapidly and drastically.
Yeah. Okay.
Hatches anytime and anywhere are a matter of chasing them, you know, just hoping you're there. Have the right flies, go fishing, and if the flies hatch, you're prepared, and if they don't, fish something else.
Right. Pete Gramp and Joe Herndon both asked about the best time of year to fish that area.
For the yellow breaches, if I had to pick one month, May is the time when the stream's got good head of water in it, typically, and that's when you get the most flies, too. You got lots of caddis flies, sulfurs, you know, different mayflies, and we probably catch most of our bigger fish at that time. Fall is also a nice time on the breaches, but that's you got to bring your A game, and that's fishing small dry flies, and you're generally not fishing for the same size fish. Smaller wild browns, as opposed to, you know, we'll get some 20-inch plus class wild fish, plus whatever stock trout decide to grab something in the spring. The other streams, big spring, it's good year-round, other than maybe when they're spawning, and the rainbows will start anytime now. I saw fresh red over there 2 days ago. I didn't see fish on it, but I'm sure it's rainbows. The brook trout won't start until at the least the latter part of November. So when the fish are spawning, it's a good idea to leave them alone. I see some guys throwing streamers at them anyway. But other than that, it's good. When they're done spawning by mid to late January, right on through till like now, even in the hot weather, the water stays cold.
Oh.
And you got something going on. You got terrestrials or maybe some kind of bugs hitting the water, some, you know, caddis or something going on, little olives. Same thing on the Latorte. The spawn will really get going over there after mid-November, third week of November, and that can go for, you know, over a couple-week period maybe. You can still get some good fishing over there then. There's little cream midges hatching. It may be smaller, medium-sized fish that are not involved or maybe already finished spawning. But if you sight fish and watch for rises, you can still get a little bit of fishing. Prime time, though, again, May when the sulfurs are coming off. March, you get good fishing with little blue-wing olives, and then you can get those again in the fall. And you can get sulfurs over on the Latorte. They'll start up. You'll have the May peak, mid to late May, going into the beginning of June, first 2 weeks of June. And then as you go into July, there'll be the little pale evening duns. On a nice, cool, dry evening, they'll come off. If you go over there on a night when it's real hot and muggy and fog on the water, you won't see any flies. But you can run into them in the winter, too. It's usually a very light hatch and brings up a few fish so here and there, but just depends on the day.
So all three creeks stay clear during the winter because they are spring creeks? They don't ice up?
Yeah, and again, the yellow breeches can vary. Well, I suspect tomorrow it's going to be on the muddy side. We're getting pounded right now. But the Big Spring and the Latorte will be clear tomorrow. I remember going over to the Big Spring one time. We had three hurricanes in 1 week through here a few years ago.
Yeah.
There was a lot of water in it, but it was gin clear. So
no,
if you
no,
get
what
some
I was local
talking runoff,
about, no, what I was talking about clear was during the winter. They don't ice up?
No, they don't ice up. The yellow breeches might get some slush ice in a few stretches, but not, for the most part, no. It has to be a really cold
long
winter.
Yeah.
Has to be a really cold snap to get any ice of any kind. And the true spring creeks, Big Spring and Latorte, won't get any ice at all on them.
Yeah, yeah. Jeff in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania asked where you would suggest a first timer to go, Big Spring, Latorte, and Yellow Breeches to start fishing. Is one of those an easier one to fish than another?
Yes, the Yellow Breeches is certainly the most user-friendly stream in the area. The Big Spring with the wild rainbows are real spooky, and the brook trout, they're all hiding. You don't even really see them. At least you can see the rainbows. But they're real spooky. You make a bad cast, they take off. The brown trout and the Latorte are even worse. So not novice water. That's their graduate school. The Yellow Breeches has a nice selection of both at this time of year, not too many fresh stock trout, but there's still some holdover stock trout. And some sections, everybody thinks they're all upstream from Boiling Springs, but the entire length of the Yellow Breeches has sections where it has fair numbers of wild brown trout in it. And it's a fairly user-friendly stream. You can get in. If you don't splash around too much, put a little fly on this time of year, mostly a little dry fly will move something, a big ant or something like that. It's pretty user-friendly. You can fish the water, you know, hit the little riffles and look for fish rising here and there. It's going to help when it cools off, but it's more user-friendly. As far as Big Spring, there's a couple spots, the middle parking lot in the catch-and-release area. You can fish a little bit of it from the bank, but it's flat water, and the very upper part of that stretch has some riffles. You can try in there. It will also relate to a later question here. You can kind of put your wellies on and stay pretty high and dry. It's not serious wading at all. You might get out there ankle deep on occasion, but just down below that parking lot's another stretch, too. It's good to have some boots on. You'll get muddy otherwise, but you don't wade the stream, per se. The Latorte, there's not too much of that that you're not going to – you need at least hip boots. I don't like to – get in there without boots on because it's real swampy, and the water's cold, though. If you've been in there for a while, even on a hot day, you know, it's cold.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, we had another question about from Pete Graham, and you may have addressed it a little bit here, but maybe you can do it more specifically. He says, unfortunately, he's epileptic and can only fish from shore on doctor's orders. So are there any recommendations where he can still have a chance to fish but not – not do any wading?
Yeah, the section of right in Boiling Springs, below Boiling Springs Lake, that little old mill race is known locally as the Little Run. And there's a couple little stretches in there. You can kind of stand on the bank or whatever and fish. It's not very big at all. It's 30, 40 feet wide, something like that. There's always fish in there. They stock it, and there's wild browns and a few wild rainbows in it. And there's a couple little spots. You can literally fish it from the bank without getting in there at all. The main yellow reaches, there's not too many areas. It being a larger stream, the upper reaches where it's small or brushy along the banks, so it's hard to fish from the bank. And downstream, it's bigger water, and you really do need to get out in there a little bit. Big spring, again, there's the one stretch, particularly around the second parking lot. A few spots around the upper parking lot and up in the old ditch region if you want to go mess around, fish for the brook trout, and there are a few rainbows up there. Nobody wades that. It looks like it's about 2 feet deep, but if you jump in there, you'd find out it was right up to your armpits. So you fish it from the bank, trust me. And that's fishing little midges and some terrestrials and things up there, a few little scuds and midge larvae and pupa. So there's a couple spots you can bank fish. Not too much on the Latorte. Same thing.
Okay. One of the questions I kind of skipped before was Joe Herndon asked about what's the best place to fly in if you're going to fish your area. What's the best city to fly into?
If you're on regular commercial airline, Harrisburg International Airport's maybe 45 minutes from Boiling Springs. Sweet little airport, real easy in and out. If you have access to a private small plane, there's an airport right on the edge of Carlisle Airport. A guy I just had out this past weekend, I dropped him off. His son dropped him off, flew him in there and dropped him off, and I dropped him off over there to fly out. So it's 10 minutes from Boiling Springs. Yeah, that's – it'll take small jets, but mostly it's little prop planes.
Yeah, good. Okay, we need to take another quick break here, Tom, and be right back. We'll talk more about flies and techniques and more detail about some of these creeks. Okay, Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly tying, fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option to wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit dryflies.com. That's dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Tom Baltz about the Pennsylvania Trio. If you'd like to ask Tom a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, another question from Pete Gramp. He wanted to know, what is your typical rod line weight setup? What are you fishing with this there, and you know, what kind of leader tippet terminal tackle are you set up for?
Okay. Probably the simplest way to address that would be to start with the spring creek fishing. Most people are going to be comfortable with something in the 8.5 to 9 foot, maybe 4 weight line range. And I'll even fish down to 2 weights on big spring and pretty long leaders, but most people are not going to deal with that. You got a 2 weight outfit with a 12 or 13 foot leader on there. That's, you can't fish in any wind. But, a 4-weight outfit typically, but you're going to be looking at fairly long leaders. You know, 11 or 12 feet would be kind of on the short end of things. I wouldn't go much shorter than, say, that 11-foot range. That's for standard dry fly and sight nymph fishing. For the yellow breeches, depends on the time of the year a little bit. If I'm going to be out in the spring, the water's up, unless there's a lot of bugs on the water and the trout are coming up, we're going to be nymph fishing. And so you're looking at 8.5 foot, 9 foot, 4 weight, 5 weight outfit. And you're going to be doing anything from indicator nymphing to check nymphing. The long flat pools, I'll indicator nymph them because you can real long drifts. And the pocket water, riffly water, the runs and holes and things, check nymphing or some of those European methods work really well. you'll have to tie your own flies or find somebody to tie them, but there's a lot of different ways to set up for that. So that'd be a real general beginning there. Now, in the late season here, especially on the breaches, again, I like to fish these smaller dry flies, and I'm not talking about 24s, but 16s to 20, 22, maybe if I really have to. 7, 7 1⁄2 foot, 2 weight, 3 weight, 4 weight maybe, 10 foot leader. As far as the X value of my tippet, that's definitely related to the fly that I'm using. Yeah, the old rule of thumb is to divide the hook size by 4. That gives you your tippet diameter. Now, the length of the tippet varies depending on the wind resistance or weight, if you're fishing nymphs, of the fly. If you're fishing something not very wind resistant, you're going to use a pretty long tippet as opposed to something with a lot of hackle or something on it. Maybe some of the foam terrestrial patterns are a little flat out, a little bit heavier than those similar flies that are tied with fur and feathers. So there's some variables. There's no strict answer on that. But match your tippet size to your fly size, and don't fish too fine, and fish as long a tippet as you can control. You need to get the fly to the target. And as far as, I very seldom fish finer than 5X. That's with anything on any of these creeks. Once in a great while, maybe 6X. I have to have some picky fish, maybe trico fishing or something. I haven't used 7X for years.
Okay. Another question from Pete Gramp. Are there any insects in these waters that they're known for more than other insects? So I know Tom Sipe in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, was asking about the whitefly hatch. Mm-hmm. So does that play a role here in Pete's question as well? Is the whitefly on all these rivers, or is it just one?
The whitefly is on the yellow breaches, and that was really a signature hatch on that stream for many, many years. Very heavy hatch at one time. And people came from far and wide late August to fish that thing. It's not as heavy as it used to be, and nobody's certain as to why that is. But, you know, some hatches are better than they used to be, and some aren't as good as they used to be at the same time. The whitefly particularly is a more of a warm water insect and marginal trout stream insect. So to me, the whitefly not being quite as heavy on some sections of the breaches is telling me that we have actually probably a little better habitat for trout. I know there's more wild trout in those same stretches that we used to fish the whitefly in when it was so heavy. But then when it was real heavy, it was more stock trout and some of the other little flies. There was a little tiny whitefly, it was like a 28, that used to show up about that same time of year. I haven't seen those for years. And they were only on when the weather was really hot and the water was basically too warm for trout. So I'm kind of taking that as I miss the old whitefly days, but overall that might be a good thing. It's hard to say. And then typically that, I'm going to just address Tom Sipe's question from Greensburg, also about the whitefly. Typically it was around the middle of August, August 15th, but I've seen them vary from the very tag end of July at least once to a week or more past the middle of August, too. So, and then they used to last until, I can remember fishing them in some sections, at least until October. But it seems to be heavy for a couple of nights, if you're there those first few nights when it really gets cranked up. And then it tapers off and pretty much over by now.
Okay. And what about the Latorte or Big Spring? Are those known for any particular hatches?
Latorte, probably signature hatch with the sulfurs, and that covers a couple of different kinds of mayflies. Back in the day, Vince, I think, maybe Charlie Fox, named the blue-wing sulfurs were the larger, what some guys will call ephemerella invaria or rotunda. The pale sulfurs were otherwise known in other places known as pale evening duns. Those are the ones that come on in the summer when it's like, oh, in July they start after that early hatch. That's probably the nicest hatch on the Latorte if you can get into them. Big Spring doesn't get a whole lot of predictable hatches in the large fly sense. It's got midges. So that's what it was always known for. And but you know, terrestrials, and it'll get a few sulfurs, and it's got some scattered caddis, and it's got some of the big October caddis, which we'll start seeing any time now. I saw a few on the breaches here this past weekend already, so you'll see those on the on Big Spring as well.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Good. And Josh from Utah wrote in a rather long question, but I think basically he's trying to get to, and I'll go ahead and read this, but get to the idea of, you know, how you set up in a general sense for different types of water, whether it be muddy or fast or deep or so forth. So here's this, here's this question. For these different types of water, muddy or low visibility, fast, fast and deep, shallow, shallow and clear, what fly combinations would you recommend for someone who doesn't know the water they are going to fish to bring with them for fishing opportunistically, and what sets would they bring for fishing selectively? I realize every river and stream probably has its ideal setups, but let's say it's just from a generalist standpoint. And also, let's say you're talking with about someone who is going to tie their flies, tying to get ready for their trip, and isn't getting information from local fly shops next to the river. So he's not having good luck getting information over the phone, he says. But that's a big, big question, Josh. But
that is. Time,
you know, it's, there's so many ifs, ands, and buts there that I know I wouldn't want to answer. But maybe, Tom, you can give a stab at it.
Well, relative to the three streams that we're talking about here, I'll cover them quickly, I think. The Latorte and Big Spring are not going to be muddy. And they're going to be anywhere from clear to Big Spring is about like as clear as water in your glass. It's extremely clear. It's not very deep, nor is the Latorte, for the most part, not very deep. So it's going to be clear and medium to medium depth to shallow depth, although medium depth and a little toward the lower reaches of it, you're not going to be wading across there. And they're going to be able to see your fly just fine. You know, I like to use, on the breaches, it can vary tremendously again. And in the fall, I use some of the high-vis flies with hot beads on them. I'll also use those flies if we get dirty water after rain or something in the spring. So for tying my flies, mostly I use very generic flies. I use the same flies everywhere, and I fish out west too, particularly. We regularly hit the Madison and the Missouri especially, which ironically is very similar to the streams here except for it's huge compared to ours. But there are certain flies I take everywhere I go. One is a parachute pattern. It's my pattern, but some kind of a, you know, I'll tell you to use it Adams, although I never use them. My pattern I call Paranymph is a parachute-style dry fly with an orange or yellow calf hair wing, not calf tail, but hair, body hair, grizzly hackle, a real rough body out of a hare's mask, and a Z-lon tail. Sort of an emerger pattern. It's a floating nymph. I carry that generally from size 12 to 20. But I had some size 8s in the box that came in handy on the Madison at least once. Don't go anywhere without caddis. Majority of them are going to run size 14 and 16, and you can, of course, always hit some on either side of that. But I found that a tan, brownish kind of a caddis pattern served me well, you know, everywhere that I've fished. If you're out anywhere from mid-spring on, terrestrials, again, out west, too, I mean, you know, you get a lot of wind out there, and it may not be hopper season, but there's ants and beetles all over the place. So that covers a lot of your generic mayflies and dry flies in general. You could hit something like, you know, I mean, you want to know if you're going to go to the Madison early in July whether the stoneflies are on or not. And if you do, you want to know where they are and then go the other direction. Some nymphs, you want to carry some generic nymphs as well. Beadhead nymphs, you know, the hare's ears, some caddis pupa type things. Again, a tannish, brownish caddis pupa in a 14, 16. It's not bad to have something in the olive, greenish range either. They have their moments. So there's a few flies like that that you want to carry everywhere. I'm not real heavy on streamer fishing, but I wouldn't feel dressed if I didn't have some willy buggers around.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there was fact, there's a question here that came in on the internet. Let me just grab it real quick since you mentioned that. Fred, and he wrote in and says, do you ever find that streamers work on the limestone creeks? Also, I should specify during daylight hours. I have fished numerous nymphs and tiny flies, but was curious about streamers for day fishing. We have all done well at night with big streamers, but I haven't had much luck in the daytime. Any advice or suggestions?
Ed Schenck was famous for, he was the first guy to develop a pattern that was called a sculpin. Don Gapin, obviously, with the muddler minnow, came up with a fly that was designed to imitate the same basic little bait fish. But Schenck's sculpin and his white minnow were both extremely effective streamers. I very seldom streamer fish.
Okay.
We're going to get into some of that a little further here. So they do work in the daytime on occasion, like all the other flies.
Yeah, okay. But do you think that is that more because of the clarity of the water or anything, or just the nature of the stream?
Partly, maybe, but also there's a lot of streamer pressure, and I'm going to address that shortly as well.
Oh, okay.
With a follow-up question here.
Okay.
Back when Ed Schenck first developed his sculpins and some of those things, actually, the Latorte was still what we call in Pennsylvania open water, where you could fish bait, and guys were fishing minnows and all kind of natural baits as well as fly fishing. So certainly, he came up with these bait fish patterns somewhere, I think, around the time when they actually changed it over to fly fishing. He was after a big trout that he hadn't caught yet, and they changed the regulations so he couldn't night fish 10-inch suckers for it anymore, and he came up with these other flies, and he caught it. But, I'm not real big on the spring creeks like Big Spring and the Latorte. I'm not real big on streamer fishing. The breaches is big enough water, and occasionally they do come into play and have their uses, at which point that's certainly day fishing. I have night fished that stream in the past, but.
Yeah, okay, good. Another question from Josh in Utah. He says, when time flies for fish, you know you're getting fish you know are getting a good look at your fly. Is it best to slim down the silhouette? Are there any color and material choices one would consider? For example, lighter versus darker, natural versus synthetic?
I think by the nature of his question, he's already on the right track. When the water is really clear, I'm going to use a more subtle presentation in general, which if I'm trying to imitate or suggest a particular bug, obviously I'm going to match size first, number one consideration. Silhouette's also important. If I've got a slender bug, I don't want to be tying or throwing a fat fly at them. I think most of the aquatic insects, especially caddisflies, mayflies, are pretty delicate, and so I tend to make my flies pretty delicate too. Material, colors, things like that, I use it mostly natural materials, but there's too many good synthetics out there to ignore them too. And I've gotten to be a fan of some of the little things that you can add to your dubbing, a little bit of sparkle here and there. I do a lot of my own blends up and things like that, so I'm adding a little bit of ice dub or something similar to any number of my flies. It's hard to say whether that really makes them more effective or I just like them better.
Okay. So are you saying basically, you know, on the spring creeks, are these fish going to be more finicky? Do you need to match that hatch much closer than you would maybe on other streams?
If they're feeding on a particular insect, I think you ought to be pretty close. Again, size first, shape second, color, especially in dry flies, is a distant third. But, the water is not real fast. It's not ripping, rushing water, especially like you might be familiar with in the Rocky Mountains. These are low gradient streams, and the Latorte and the Big Spring particularly, but a lot of the yellow breeches, too, are flat water, and it's moving fairly slow, so they're going to get a pretty good look at your bug, and I'm going to tie a reasonably sparse, slender fly, something pretty delicate, especially in those slow water stretches.
Okay. Another question, Pete Gramp. He's just prolific tonight on his questions here, and I appreciate that. He says, what are your top flies for this water? Do they vary by season, water temperature? Do certain waters do better for dries versus nymphs versus streamers?
Again, the spring creeks, I would say normally when I would go to Big Spring, I'm hoping for dry fly fishing first. The water's okay. So clear. The fish, even the big trout in there, are very surface-oriented. And if they're in any kind of good mood at all, they'll come up for flies. Second thing I'm going to look for would be more or less sight nymph fishing. And the Latorte, kind of the same thing. I'm going to hope for dry fly fishing, and if that's not happening, I'm going to put on a little Sawyer pheasant tail or some similar nymph and try and spot some fish. A crest bug is also, or a scud, you know, a.k.a. freshwater shrimp, or two other necessary subsurface flies for the spring creeks. The yellow breeches, again, going to vary tremendously. Depends on whether I'm fishing small water or big water, and whether it's spring when the water's higher typically, and I'm going to be looking to probably fish nymphs, or low and clear like it's been just lately, in which case I'm hoping to fish dry flies. Again, streamers are pretty low on my list. If
right.
I have to fish streamers, I might stay home and tie dry flies.
Okay, there you go.
All right. To each his own.
I think we got the picture, Tom.
To each his own, again.
Yeah, right.
You know, the streamers do have their moments on the streams.
Yeah, yeah. And it's nice to have a place where there's so much dry fly fishing, you know. It's not that way everywhere else. So it's nice that you have that opportunity.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so let's go through each one of the streams quickly here. We're running out of time, but a few questions about each one. You've talked about each one in great depth already, but let's just pick them apart a little bit more. Speaking just about the Latorte, what in your mind, what makes the Latorte special?
Again, it was the men who fished it who were really thinking and progressively minded fly fishers who found a stream that presented a tremendous challenge, which was fish that were rising in the daytime. All, you know, even in the summer, in the very hot months, these were fish that would surface feed very well in the daytime, and they figured out how to catch them and came up with a whole way of thinking about the flies that they use, and that was, of course, written about by both Charlie Fox and Vince Marinaro in Vince's book, Modern Dry Fly Code, also further continued in his book, In the Ring of the Rise, highly recommended reading. So that's kind of what made that special. They're unique streams. If I say trout stream, most people are not going to picture these streams. They're flat. They're gliding around through bends with a lot of aquatic vegetation in them. You're spot and stock fishing, and all those make these streams a little bit unique as opposed to, you know, more freestone or riffly rapid water type streams.
Sounds like a guy from England would feel quite at home there, huh?
I've guided fishermen from England there who told me that parts of the Latorte looked just exactly like the Upper Itchen, and they also felt quite at home on the on the Big Spring. Breaches,
right.
Again, a little bit different, but we'll talk just the Latorte. Quick tour, runs south to north, right through Carlisle, 6-point-some miles, empties into the Conedogwinet Creek. The upper reach is about almost 2 miles of catch-and-release area, fly fishing only. Access is excellent. You can get in the upper reaches near Bonnybrook Road and also further downstream off of Spring Garden Street just up above Carlisle. And then you got to walk in between those two access points, but that also can give you a little bit of solitude on there. You're not going to run it.
Talking about stream access, what are the right laws in Pennsylvania? You know, out west here we have ownership under the water. We have, you know, in like Montana, if you can get access, you can walk below the high water mark. But if you can get to the stream, can you basically walk up and down it? Is that the...
No.
No. Okay. Okay.
In Pennsylvania, it's a case-by-case basis, but they have to... they have to meet navigability requirements.
Oh,
by the state of Pennsylvania, not federal. So it doesn't mean you can float a steamship on it, but they have to have a documented history of commerce. A notable case, which made national headlines again, was on the Little Juniata in central Pennsylvania, where a guy decided he could privatize a stretch, and some other guys decided that they could fish there, and it ended up that they could, and that was based on a history of commerce, which was primarily floating logs down the thing, maybe a little bit of other stuff. And it also, the way deeds are written and things like that all come into play, but a stream that doesn't match the navigability, which would certainly be the Yellow Breeches, Big Spring, and the Tort, the landowners generally own to the center of the stream, but again, depending upon an individual deed, they could own both banks or none of the water. Our TU chapter owns some of the upper water, and above Bonnybrook Road, we own the stream to the all the way up to the far edge on the left side. So we own the meadow and the whole stream to the left bank. Right below the road, we only own up to the right bank. We don't own any of the stream in that particular spot. So there's just two adjacent sections where we own none of it and all of it. It's open to fishing, courtesy of the landowners and courtesy of our TU chapter providing those parking areas. Big Spring, the Fish Commission owns, so you can fish that whole thing. The Yellow Breeches has a few posted stretches, and it can get a little tricky because there's signs in places that say posted, but they're not posted, and there's signs in places that are posted, and they mean what they say. So it can be a little tricky to sort out, but there's only a couple stretches. It's you'd have to go out of your way to wander into them. So access throughout the state can be a little sketchy that way.
Okay, okay. So what makes the Yellow Breeches special to you?
What makes the breeches special to me is its diversity. Again, the upper reaches are small, tight quarters. If you like small stream fishing, little rods, can be some nice fish in there. Extremely difficult to catch. It's getting more fishing pressure than it used to. They stock it a little, but there's some wild fish up there that are worth chasing. And then you can follow it downstream to the lower reaches where it's decent-sized water, and you have to watch where you're wading around. And also some wild fish scattered throughout. Some of them can be sizable. I've had clients take wild fish up to 22 inches plus, but anything 14, 15, up to 18, and I'd be really pleased with any of those on a given day. But you get a nice variety of fly hatches that you don't get on the pure spring creeks, Latorte and Big Spring. So, and being user-friendly, you can usually find a stretch that you can catch a few fish on without sweating too hard about it. You'll sweat on Big Spring and the Latorte both.
Okay. Rob from Middleton, Pennsylvania, he says, as a novice living in Middleton, Pennsylvania, I love parking at Allenberry, playhouse, and fishing the Yellow Breeches. With access being denied due to their purchase, I was wondering what your favorite access may be for fly fishing only. Also, do you go winter fly fishing on the breeches? So there's a closure of some sort?
Well, the Allenberry Resort, which owns some of the stream in the lower part of the catch and release area, has changed hands, and presently access through that area, from what I understand, is cut off, and that's due to them doing heavy-duty construction and remodeling down there. They've got heavy equipment all over it, and I'm certain that, at the very least, that that's due to insurance issues. How that's going to shake out this time next year, I really don't know at this point. I do not think you're going to be driving in and parking down on the meadow anymore. I hope there's going to be access through there one way or another, but remains to be seen. The upper reaches, right now, presently, you can park below the lake in Boiling Springs at that parking area by the Iron Furnace, at the run, and you can walk down and fish the stream if you stay in there and mind your own business. You'll be okay. How that's going to shake out, again, in the long run, I don't know. Now, as far as for other than that, if we do maintain special regulations on there, which I don't know what the Fish Commission's thinking at this point. There's so many new developments at this point, things are change almost daily. But you can fly fish anywhere on the stream. I would encourage you especially to go out in the spring when they're literally trout all up and down the thing between the wild fish and whatever trout are stocked in there from the very upper reaches around Huntsdale to its mouth on the Susquehanna. There's going to be some place that there's going to be trout. Go do some exploring. There's plenty of places to park, usually bridges. The pullover spots are pretty obvious. You can see where people have been parking. So get out there and go do some exploring. There's plenty of water that's open. Winter fishing, I don't do as much of it as I used to, but it's mostly going to be fishing with nymphs and streamers. You know, go with some beadhead hare's ears and maybe some of the newer European-style nymphs, the Czech nymphs, and then a little French-type nymphs. The beadheads, a little bit of flash on them. Those are all deadly flies. And, you know, if the water's not too cold, you might be able to get them to hit a woolly bugger. Or, you know, if you have a favorite streamer, go for it. When the water's cold, I find those fish do like to eat meat. So you're not going to get a lot of dry fly fishing unless you get a real warm spell, which is not unheard of but not expected either.
Yeah. And then Big Spring, what makes it special to you?
Well, water stays extremely cold, and a good head of wild brook trout and stream-bred rainbows. When the project first, the projects that I referred to earlier first really were finished a year or so later, I mean, there was an explosion. And actually, even before some of them were put in, there was some tremendous-sized rainbows in there, and that was a big draw. Drew people from far and wide, a little too many, I think, sometimes. But nonetheless, those wild fish, the rainbows are pretty surface-oriented. They'll come up for dry flies, and yet they can certainly be challenging, too. And the brook trout, they can get pretty sizable. If you're used to chasing mountain brook trout that, you know, 8 inches is a monster, well, you know, you can hit fish that are twice that size on Big Spring. I mean, the biggest one I ever caught was over 18 inches, but I think you could expect a, or at least hope to get something in the 15, 16-inch range on occasion. So that's one of the things that makes that stream special.
Yeah, good. And there isn't a, you know, I know you don't want to fish streamers, but we did have a question from Dennis in Columbia, Maryland. It says, what is the best method of fishing streamers for the large fish in Big Spring? Standing in the creek on the bank, what is the best size streamer and type of streamer plus leader length, tippet size for this type of fishing?
I think you're going to find a lot of different answers to that. And since I don't really streamer fish in there, I don't have many of them. Frankly, personally, on that stream, I would like to see that stuff not even used. It stirs up. There's a lot of guys doing it, especially in the winter, and it keeps the fish stirred up and moving around, and even chases them out of the catch and release area. If they leave that catch and release area, believe me, they don't last too long for the most part. But, you know, there's guys fishing everything, and they're not always real big streamers. I mean, the bait fish that are in there are one or the other trout.
Right.
You know, a big trout will eat whatever he can catch. There's a little basin there that's about 2 inches long, and my friend that caught that big brown trout I talked about earlier caught it on a little streamer that was about 2 inches long on a four-weight rod. So a little pearl dacer, only a couple inches long. I'd probably imitate them if I was going to streamer fish. Yeah.
That was a fight, to be all fights, I bet, on that small rod. Now, we did get a couple other questions here on the Internet. Phil in Kentucky wants to know if there's a large number of people competing for space on these waters.
The Latorte gets fished fairly lightly. You'll get some people that come in there that want to fish. They, you know, they're in the area on vacation or whatever, and they want to go see. They've read Vince Marinaro or Charlie Fox's books and want to wet their line in the holy water, so to speak. And there's a few regulars, though, mostly local guys, but also some guys from surrounding areas that were only 2 hours or less from D.C., Baltimore, Philly's not too far away. And it has a few regular fishermen. It's not... Only time it's even close to crowded would be sulfur time in late May, first part of June maybe. Other than that, it's virtually deserted. Big Spring can get a little busy, especially in the winter, because there's no commitment there. You can park and put your wellies on and never even get wet and still manage to fish. If you get cold, you can sit in the car and warm up. So there's parking areas right along the stream, and it can get a little busy. The yellow breeches in the spring, peak season, May, you know, the bait fishermen are all over the place, too. They're out there hitting it. And, you know, you'll see some people around. Is it crowded? It depends on what you consider crowded. The catch and release area certainly had a reputation for being crowded, but I spent a lot of time down there where we were the only people fishing, too. So sometimes it's crowded, but not as often as people would lead you to believe. I mean, it can be real crowded during the white fly or some big event, day in and day out, not so bad. I had a guy out this past weekend. We fished it a couple of days. We never saw another fisherman on the water we fished. So there's some solitude there as well.
Okay, we got a question from James in, I think it's Alpine, Wyoming. And I don't know if you have these same conditions where you are, but maybe you can help him out. He says, I fish a local spring creek near Jackson Hole, Wyoming, that is full of aquatic grass. Do you have any presentation tips on how to catch, in his case, a large native cutthroat trout that are sipping trichos and tiny blueing olives in the narrow channels between the weeds?
If the weeds are emergent, in other words, sticking out of the water, that's obviously a problem. You're going to have to really gauge your cast, and we ran into that quite often on the Latorte. And you just kind of have to lay your line right across the weeds and make sure you get that fly where it's supposed to be. Of course, tricho fishing and so forth is difficult because they're not eating all the real flies either, and, you know, it's so much about timing. You have to usually make a lot of casts, especially hook the bigger fish. If they're not sticking out of the water, then you've got a chance. You're going to have to probably make slack line casts, construct your leader carefully so that you can get some slack in it. And I'm a advocate of the George Harvey type leaders, and you can get all that stuff off the internet somewhere. So as long as if the weeds are sticking out of the water, you got the problems. If they're not, they can still create a lot of swirls and boils that cause your fly to drag, but that's part of the game, and you can deal with that by casting some slack into your leader.
Sounds like it's a challenging situation for sure. Yeah.
Well, that's certainly what Spring Creek fishing. Yeah, that's what Spring Creek fishing is all about. Is those kinds of things. They tend to be that way.
Yeah. We have one final question, and I don't know if you have an answer from this, but Craig in Portland, Oregon asks, "What's the best advice or pearl of wisdom that you ever received from Vince Marinaro?"
Well. I learned more about fly tying from Vince Marinaro probably than any other single person, certainly. He taught me to think in terms of fly design and not fly pattern. Fly pattern is just a matter of changing colors. Fly design changes the way the fly acts, fishes, the way it looks to the fish. So that's, if you're a fly tier, even if you're not a fly tier, you're still tying flies on if you're fly fishing. Think about fly design rather than pattern so much. And one of the little pearls of wisdom, one of my favorite ones, was Vince once said, never measure a really good fish. Don't quantify him. Just,
enjoy.
If you think he's 18 inches and that's an honest estimate, then that's how big he is.
Yeah.
If you measure him and find out he's 16, then he's 16. So I've been guiding for a long, long time. I only ever had one client that insisted on measuring a fish.
Yeah.
I told him that fish is 21 inches. He wanted to measure it anyway. It's 21 inches. So that settled that, and that was great.
Yeah.
But I told him beforehand, if he's 19 and 3/4, then he's not 21 anymore.
Yeah.
Had a few guys, I said, you know, we'll be take an honest guess, but if we guess long and we measure him and you go tell your buddy you caught an 18-incher, I'm going to tell on you when we're eating lunch. That settles that. So, never measure a good fish. Just, you know, that's a heck of a nice fish. Enjoy it. You want to overestimate it a little bit, that's fine.
Yeah, I had a friend we went fishing with, and I swore he went out with my son and I, and we're on this trip on the San Juan River, and so he kept, he says, oh yeah, that's a 20 incher, and we go, no, Dave, it's not a 20 incher. Then we'd make him measure it, and it would be an 18. You know, he was like always inch or two higher than whatever the fish was, so we gave him hell about that. And his estimating was terrible. It was always on the high side, but I guess that made him feel good, like you say. So.
Absolutely. I've had lots of clients that overestimated them. I don't say too much. I mean, you go tell everybody you think that fish was 20 inches. I'm good with that.
That's clients. But when it's your buddy fishing, you know, you have to give them some kind of hell, right?
Oh, absolutely. If it'd be my buddy, that'd be a whole different story.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, it's we got to wrap things up here. Time has flown by, as it always does. But stick around with me, Tom, here a little bit longer. We're going to give away a few prizes and wrap things up. So when we return, we'll be giving a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. We'll also be giving away a $25 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. So stick with us a few more minutes, and we'll do just that. A mining company called Pac Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chewitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaskan history to mine directly through salmon habitat, the Chewitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. Critical commercial sport and subsistence fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pac Rim says it can rebuild a salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chewitna Coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chewitna Coal strip mine. For more information on how you can help, visit chewitna.org. That's chewitna.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the show tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what'd you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away a few prizes, and the first thing we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a great organization to support and be part of. And if you don't win tonight, you can go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, to find out more about what the Federation does. And let's see here. I got my database fired up here, and looks like we have Victor Hahn of Colorado. So, Victor, congratulations, and just won yourself a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And next up, we have a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And let's see, and if you want to learn more about that, just go to amatobooks.com. You'll find out about all the books they have on fly fishing, as well as periodicals. And Barry Laughlin in Pennsylvania. Barry Laughlin just won that, so congratulations, Barry. And to both of you, we will get these, send out an email to you with the information we need to get your membership and subscription started. So hang tight and look for an email from us, and we'll take care of that. And then lastly, we have a $25 gift certificate to give away courtesy of Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. If you get out Colorado way, be sure you check them out. It's a great shop, very friendly guys, and they have just about everything you need. So, but you can also redeem this online with them. It's not a problem, so hopefully you'll win. So here's the question. Which of the creeks we talked about tonight provides the most diverse fishing, and what hatch is it most well-known for? Which one of the creeks is the most diverse fishing, and what hatch is it famous for? So, two-part question. And we got yellow breeches and white fly. Is that correct, Tom?
That is.
That is. Okay, so Jake Jones and Yukon, Oklahoma. Just one. And congratulations, Jake. Jake, send me your address, your mailing address, and I've got your email address here and your name. So if you send that to me, then we'll be set to go. And you can do that in the same box. You just answered the question, and that'll be fine. And congratulations. Thanks for paying attention. So good for you. Well, hey, Tom, we really appreciate you being with us. It was a pleasure to talk with you and pick your brain a bit. And thanks for sharing your great part of the country with us tonight.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I hope everybody got at least a little bit of something out of it.
Oh, for sure, sure. I learned a whole heck of a lot about your area, which I'm not familiar with, but maybe someday I'll be. You know, my trouble is, after doing all these shows, I think close to 245 shows now, my bucket list is really, really long.
Yeah, I bet. Well,
longer than the years I have left, you know. So.
Hopefully, yep. I'll see some people at some of the shows coming up over the winter months here. Again, Denver, the fly fishing show in Denver, Somerset, New Jersey, both January shows, and then the Lancaster, Pennsylvania show in the beginning of March. So, you know, stop over, see what I'm tying, and chew the fat a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. So you'll find Tom in the fly tying areas. He's got his own setup there, and stop by and chat for a while and see what he's up to. That'd be great. I'm sure you'd enjoy that, huh, Tom?
So. I enjoy it thoroughly, yes.
Good, good. Well, our next broadcast will be on September 21st, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. On that show, I'll be interviewing Vince Wilcox, and our topic for the show will be tying the best-selling, most effective fly patterns. Vince has always had his own take on things, and that applies to tying flies as well. Vince developed his own patterns for many of the common challenges fly fishers face when enticing trout, and many of those have become commercial patterns you may be buying today, including nymphs, dry flies, and terrestrials. So join us to hear from Vince why he developed these patterns and why they are so effective and how to fish them. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Watermaster, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. And don't forget to visit our website. Make sure you sign up to receive our announcement at askaboutflyfishing.com. That way you won't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening with Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.